Hi, this is Jerry Brito. A quick program note before the podcast. We had some trouble with the audio this week. We apologize for the quality, and we want to let you know that it's our top priority to make the podcast sound much better in the future. So please bear with us and enjoy the show. This is episode number 10 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, April 26, 2007. I'm Jerry Brito from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Up for discussion this week, the FCC releases its report on violence in the media. What's behind the economics of abundance? And patent reform heats up in Congress. Joining me to discuss these topics are Tech Liberation Front contributors, starting with Hans Haney of the Discovery Institute. Hey, Hans.
Hey, Jerry.
Tim Lee of the Cato Institute.
Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Tim. And Adam Thierer of the Progress and Freedom Foundation.
Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Adam. Our guest this week is Mike Masnick of TechDirt.com. Hi, Mike. Glad to have you with us.
Hi, Jerry. Great to be here.
Great. Well, first up, the Federal Communications Commission releases its report on violence in the media. Adam, you've been following this issue closely. What's in the report?
Well, the FCC has just released its long-awaited report on violent television programming and its impact on children. And unsurprisingly, it recommends that the agency assume more control over the content that comes into our homes. Specifically, what the FCC is advocating in this report is that Congress give the agency the authority to regulate excessively violent programming, quote-unquote, as they've been regulating indecent content on broadcast airwaves for many years. Now, that's unprecedented, of course, because the agency has never had the authority to regulate excessively violent programming. But what's also unprecedented about this report is that the agency is requesting the authority to, in some way, shape, or form, regulate content on cable or satellite television. It's unclear if they want to regulate it or will be able to regulate it directly, or if they're going to try to use this as an excuse to impose a la carte regulation on the cable and satellite industry. Either way, this is an ambitious report that basically advocates the FCC have a whole new role as sort of a national nanny of our homes to ensure that our kids don't see violent programming. And needless to say, it's a complete betrayal of the First Amendment. It's probably likely to be struck down as unconstitutional, but we'll have to go through years of court cases to probably get to that point.
Adam, how would they define what is too violent?
So, Adam, what are the concrete steps?
The FCC, surprisingly, because there is no single accepted definition, whether it be in the quote-unquote scientific literature on this, or even from the media critics out there. And in fact, right off the bat, in the second paragraph of the FCC report, there is a question that's raised about how the agency said there's a broad range of, this is the agency speaking, quote, a broad range of television program aired today contains violent content, including, for example, cartoons, dramatic series, professional sports such as boxing, news coverage, and nature programs. Everything on TV is bad for us now. And the agency goes from one page to another, dodging the issue along the way about how we're going to define things. At one point, the agency even suggests that maybe it will look to scientists or psychologists to help them define it. I mean, how in the heck is that going to work? Are we going to have the American Psychological Association have veto power over whether it's a completely open-ended, ambiguous kind of document? But you know what? It doesn't make any difference. That's what the agency's after, ambiguous authority to regulate content. They've already got a little bit of that in the field of indecency.
So, Adam, what are the concrete steps that the agency is pursuing as sort of the first steps to...
Well, specifically, the first thing the agency needs is some sort of clear congressional authority or mandate that says they can move forward on this front. So there's a very interesting game being played here where Congress requested that the FCC do a report telling Congress what the Congress could do to give the FCC more powers to regulate. I mean, what a racket, huh? I mean, basically, you know what the answer is going to be there. The FCC's... So that part of it will be solved in fairly short order. You'll see legislation introduced probably within the next couple of weeks saying, yeah, go for it, FCC, start regulating. But then the FCC requests that Congress consider going beyond that and potentially opening up cable and satellite to some form of regulation to, quote-unquote, clean up cable, whether it be direct content regulation or some sort of an a la carte mandate.
So the first round of legislation would just apply to broadcast television?
That's probably right, because that's where they are in the safest ground in terms of already having some authority, constitutionally speaking. Unfortunately, our Supreme Court has allowed the FCC to regulate in that space already. So there's a good chance that they have a better chance of getting some authority there, constitutionally speaking, than cable and satellite, where I think it's a real long shot. That being said, at some point, the court's about to deliver, literally any day now, decisions in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals and the Third Circuit Court of Appeals on whether or not the FCC has been overreaching on indecency law. And everybody seems to agree that the courts are probably going to come back with a slant in trying to enforce its indecency standards, and the fines have gotten out of control and everything else. So it's not a closed case in terms of does the agency have the authority to regulate broadcasting in this fashion, but only time will tell, and only basically court cases will tell what the ultimate answer is.
How does the a la carte angle fit into all this? Is this more sort of regulating by threatening, regulating by blackmail?
Right. Well, a la carte regulation, of course, is the idea of unbundling cable and selling each channel, channel by channel, that is, to the public. And there's a lot of people who have been proposing that for quite some time. What's interesting now, however, is that that economic debate has been cast in social content regulation terms. That is, the FCC and many other social conservative groups are claiming that a la carte will help, quote-unquote, clean up cable by allowing parents to screen out things they don't like. The problem with that theory is that at the end of the day, if you unbundle cable and you make every channel sort of sink or swim on their own, the reality is that the channels that the social conservatives hate, like MTV or FX, those channels are going to continue to do just fine and dandy. So the stuff that they think is smutty or whatever is going to programmers and evangelists or nature programs or something like that, that stuff's going to go first. So I find it very ironic that they're casting this as a moral crusade to clean up cable, and it's ultimately, I believe, going to backfire on them and just result in the stuff that they hate most getting more eyeballs.
All right. Thanks a lot, Adam. We'll keep an eye on that. Next up, the economics of abundance. Mike, you've been arguing with Dilbert creator Scott Adams about this. What's the argument about?
it depends on how you view whether or not it's really an argument or just something that he threw up for fun, which is what a lot of people are suggesting now. But he had posted something to his blog, basically taking the opinion that a lot of people certainly take, that any kind of copyright infringement is effectively the equivalent of theft. And so I had responded to that and pointed out all the many reasons why copyright infringement, while certainly illegal right now, is not the equivalent of theft. And there are a number of big differences. And I was a little bit upset that I thought Scott Adams had given not enough credence to, or probably hadn't even looked at some of the opposing opinions. And just stated things as if, you know, very, on a very emotional basis rather than on any kind of logical basis.
Mike, you were trying to make a broader point of beyond just whether or not copyright is theft, weren't you?
Well, certainly. I mean, there's a lot of points that I'm trying to make, but you know, effectively, you know, the idea that if you understand the basic economics behind the content and how it works, that you can do a lot more almost ignoring copyright. And in fact, you can grow your market much larger and really profit to a much greater level if you know when to ignore copyright, whether or not the law exists. Effectively, even if the law exists and even if you can control your content, if you understand that the economics appropriately, you can completely ignore it and probably do a lot better for yourself. And that was the point that I was making, which certainly didn't enter into the discussion much on his side.
What would be an example of that?
Well, I mean, just recognizing the idea that the content itself, once created, since it has no marginal cost to create another copy, can effectively be used as a very, very useful resource in promoting something else, something that is scarce and that does cost money, that does have a marginal cost, so that you can effectively get free promotion to grow the size of your market and sell whatever is scarce. And depending on what it is that you're selling, if it's music, it can be concerts or access to the musicians or even the creation of new content are the types of things that you can sell. And the only way you do that and can get enough money in doing that is to have enough people who are interested in what you do and interested in your music. And the way you do that is use the music that you've created in the past as free promotional material for that new scarce resources.
Mike, what you're proposing is a new model of how you would profit from intellectual creativity. The current model is you create artificial scarcity through copyright law. You're suggesting that there's a different way. Why is your way better? You know what I'm saying? Why would it create more wealth?
Oh, well, it's easy. I mean, if you just look at the basics of growth economics, I mean, it's knowledge and ideas and the ability to take those things and use them to enhance the value of any particular scarce work resource. So these non-scarce resources delivered growth and delivered a larger market. And so anytime you focus not on limiting resources but on expanding those resources, you're from the very beginning expanding the market, extract the profits from that, right? Because not only does it expand the market, it does change the dynamics of the market. And I think that's really the point that people are most scared about, because they're very, very used to an existing business model that has worked and made some people an awful lot of money. The way of extracting that money has changed. And what they're realizing is that even with the market being much larger, the people who used to be able to extract the most money from it don't get to extract all of the money from it, which is extract all the money from it.
Don't you think that there are some industries where it'll be very difficult to apply this, tens of millions of dollars on a movie, and the prime, whatever, but the primary thing you're selling is copies of the movie.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that's not, and the founder of the Lowe's theater chain was probably said this the best, where he always said, we're not selling movies, we're selling tickets to the theater, and really what the movie industry has always been selling is an entertainment product, and it's an entertainment product. So they've always really had a service component, and that component has always been a scarce resource. There are only so many seats in the movie theater, and people want to have that good experience of going out with a bunch of people and seeing a movie in comfortable seats on a big screen with a great sound system. And if you put in place the right incentives, that doesn't change. People still want to go out, and they still want to have a good time. They still want to be with their friends. You can still do that. Of course, the theaters these days don't seem to understand that. They keep making the experience worse, which I think is a bigger problem than any kind of copyright infringement or piracy or whatever they want to call it these days. But they've always been selling. And so, the incentives that you can put in place, certainly, you could do T-shirts and stuff, but you can go much, much further than that and give incentives for people to actually go to the theater beyond, having that really good experience. And people have talked about things like, if you go to the theater, your ticket acts as a discount on getting the hard copy of the DVD as you walk out of the theater if you want it, or maybe it's a discount to the sequel of the movie. Should a sequel ever be made, or all sorts of other things that you can put in place that give people incentives to actually go out and experience that that social experience of going out to the movies that have nothing to do with copyright.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike. Well, moving on to another IP issue. Patent reform is heating up in Congress with a new bill. Hans, what's the latest?
Well, this bill, the long-awaited bill, has finally been introduced by the chairman and the ranking member of the relevant committees of jurisdiction in the Senate and the House. And, of course, the expectation is that a lot of time and energy is going to go into this in this session of Congress. What I write on the blog, particularly in the software and business methods areas, which are newly patentable areas, the utility, novelty, and non-obviousness requirements haven't been consistently applied or as the rule against vagueness. And so there's a need to resurrect all of these things, these traditional tools. Unfortunately, patent quality usually comes down to a plea for more funding for the patent office, which would allow the patent office merely to subsidize its pre-existing weaknesses. On the positive side, though, the proposal in Congress does permit third parties to submit relevant prior art to the patent office, which means there's more information in front of the examiner, which, hopefully will lead to higher quality patents. And additionally, another positive in this is that the definition of willful infringement, which is important because if you knew there was a patent, you're subject to treble damages. Even if you thought the patent didn't apply or it was too vague, you didn't understand it, if you had some good faith reason, you were still subject to treble damages. And so what that led to in a lot of cases is people didn't even look at the patents. They didn't even try to figure out whether there was conflict. So that's changed now. There now has to be an intent to copy a patented invention, acknowledged that it was patented. So that's been tightened up, and that's positive. Unfortunately, there's also some stuff in here which is going to lead to harassment of patent owners. And the patent office is authorized to issue regulations to prevent that kind of abuse, but we don't know what those are going to be. And I'll just quickly highlight two. One, that reform always includes proposals to limit damage awards. Because some field of litigation doesn't produce predictable damage awards. And while some predictability is necessary, absolute predictability can be dangerous because the more predictable a penalty is for wrongful conduct, the more easily it can be for corporations to factor it in as in the cost of doing business. So I discuss this, in more detail on our blog. Another area is a new and unnecessary layer of post grant that's going to limit the incentive of interveners to participate in the front end of the process, leading to uncertainty throughout the life of the patent, which, I'm arguing is going to be harmful to investors, employees, suppliers, all of whom are participating in the development and the marketing of the new innovation in good faith and will be the people who pay the highest price in the event that a subsequent review indicates that the patent wasn't valid in the first place. So there's some good, but there's also some bad in that as well.
Hans, you mentioned that a big part of the motivation for this is that software and business method patents are a new idea. And as I understand it, that change was made by the U.S. Court of Appeals to the Federal Circuit with basically no input for Congress. Is there any talk on the Hill about starting with the original question, which is why are these patentable in the first place, and did the Federal Circuit make a mistake by making them patentable?
No, I mean that's not in this legislation.
What do you think is the likelihood that the legislation goes anywhere?
This is really hazardous. I'm going to guess slightly less than 50-50, and that is wildly speculative. We've seen, efforts to reform the patent system throughout history. Some of them have been successful, but in this instance, the forces arrayed against principally the software industry, where the principal, impetus for this is coming from, I think are pretty formidable. And so I would just, bet that it's slightly less than 50%. But I think the courts, the Supreme Court in particular, under our new Chief Justice, who has an interest in commercial litigation, and has accepted review on a large number of patent cases, is going to make the tweaks that are necessary in the system to bring it back into balance. So I think ultimately, I'm not very troubled if Congress doesn't pass patent reform legislation.
Just to follow up my previous question, do you have any thoughts about why that's not a subject for debate? I mean, it seems like there have been quite a lot of problems, and it seems like software business method patents, there wasn't anybody clamoring for it before the 90s when the Federal Circuit really started to. Why there's not more debate on the Hill about whether that's a good idea in the first place?
I just suspect, Tim, that it's partly because the software industry has adapted to the status quo and has accumulated these large portfolios, the nuclear arsenals, as you call them, and uses cross-licensing. And so it becomes a sword and a shield. And so I think that now you've got a situation where, like I say, they've adapted to it and see some advantages in it. That's my suspicion.
Yeah, that makes sense.
All right. Thanks a lot, Hans. Well, that's going to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this time. Thanks to Hans Haney, Tim Lee, Adam Thierer, and Mike Masnick. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry.
To read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you have something to say about something we said, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this show. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend. Please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Jerry Brito. See you next time.